Hello and welcome to Psychobilly Australia, the podcast. First things first, thank you so much for your patience and waiting for this one. It has taken me a little bit of time to get this podcast out, but hey, I'm finally there and, well, let's be thankful for that. Anyway, I'm your host, Wolfman Dan. You may remember me from a radio show way back when called Lick It Up and Lack It Down. I used to do that show with my good friend, the Rockabilly Rhino. Anyway, let me introduce my next guest. He is an amazing guitar player. He has a very successful YouTube channel going at the moment, and he's doing some absolutely fantastic stuff as well on the gig scene. Please welcome Adrian White. How are you, my friend?
I'm good, Daniel. How are you?
I'm doing good, man. I'm doing good. It's great to see you, man. It's been a while.
It's been a long time. There's been a few years between proverbial drinks.
Yes, exactly. A bit more facial hair going on too, I think.
There's a lot more. Yeah, I was quite clean shaven back then, but I figured as I got older, it would be good to hide the aging, I guess.
Yeah. So I use that excuse as well. Mate. It's all good.
Oh, look, I'm doing.
Mind you, the grey.
Yeah, doing my best to keep young though, but with two little kids, I tell you. It's
Yes, two kids. They certainly add the greys as well, don't they?
They do. I don't have that beautiful quiff anymore. I've given up on that. So I just those comb strokes. I think was pulling hairs out. I didn't realize. So
yeah, I kind of feel the same way, mind you. I think my hair's more due to laziness than, actually being bothered to do anything with it. So,
yep.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at these days.
Same goes for the facial hair, really.
Yeah, no, that's right. Yeah, a lot of people were quite shocked when I got rid of my beard after I had it for, like, oh, geez, about 15-odd years, I think.
I remember I remember you posting that on Facebook.
Yeah, quite a few people were a bit shocked.
I didn't know who it was. I was like, who's posting this? I didn't. I was like, who's Daniel posting a picture of? Who's Dan posting a picture of you?
Yeah. He's good looking still, but yeah.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
Oh, you're a gentleman, you know that. You're saying nice things. Look, one of the things that I wanted to start off about is currently you're doing some really, really cool things with YouTube at the moment and your Patreon as well.
Yep.
How did that all start for you? When did you decide to start all that?
Well, it's a strange story in a way. I got serious about it in 2020. So I'd been posting videos on and off for a long time, but I'd never taken it seriously. You know, a little bit of a shame, really, because I kind of, you know, went through the years where if you had a reasonably solid video, you could get really good views and pick up a lot of audience. And I did. I had some videos that went really well. I'd put out, a video on Psychobilly Blues, which is just a basic idea of psychobilly with a simple chord progression, a blues progression. And that's had like 185,000 views, for example. And but it's just so much harder to achieve that now because it's so flooded and YouTube has, you know, they've become very specific about the kind of videos they push. But I was making videos on and off for 10 years. Several years at that point, but at the start of 2020, I actually saw that a friend of mine who'd asked me to help him make videos to promote they're like portable hot water heaters for camping and stuff. It was really random. He knew that I was doing YouTube videos, and he said, "Hey, you do these YouTube videos where you teach stuff. Can you teach people how to use our product?" And I was like, "Yeah, sure." He's a good mate, and I was like, "I'll do that," but I didn't take it seriously. So I'd rock up to do these things and he'd send me paperwork on how to use this heater and I didn't look at it or anything. I was too busy playing guitar, you know, or whatever. And so I'd muffle my way through it and I'd be asking questions to the cameraman, like, what was this called again? And they loved it. They thought it was the funniest thing. And so they kind of built, they got me to do a lot of videos and I helped build their brand a lot. And there's some of their videos have hundreds of thousands of views and it's me. They're called Julka, by the way, J-O-O-L-C-A, Julka. And it's funny, so if anyone wants to look it up and have a laugh. And I even had my quiff and everything. It was so weird, but they loved it. People would ring them and say, does Adrian actually work there? You know, I became like this, unknown celebrity in their world, which I have nothing to do with anyway. Mm-hmm. And one day I was looking at what they'd been up to, and they had employed an agency to kind of replicate my style. It was really weird. Mm-hmm. They had an actor going, throwing in these really bad jokes. Like sometimes I get some real bad jokes into my lessons as well. In my private lessons, I don't stop making bad jokes. It's a whole other thing.
Well, you're a dad, you know, it's like comes with the territory.
Man, I was there 10 years before I had kids. That's the weird thing. I just making people cringe with bad
jokes.
Gives you,
it's just a license now. That's all.
Now it's acceptable. So, yeah, look, I saw these videos and I was like, they're taking off my style. And at first it kind of annoyed me. I was like, that's my thing. That agency have taken my casual kind of she'll be right attitude. Mm-hmm. And they're using that now. And I actually spoke to my friend. I'm like, you guys kind of pinched my style. And I think he didn't really think of it that way. And I didn't care at all. I was more than happy for him and the company, but he kind of sort of laughed it off. But I could see him going, yeah, I sort of see your point, actually. Like, that's what that agency had done. So when I saw that, I kind of thought, well, why am I not using whatever it is that I do in something regular and building something? And that's when I went, hang on. My YouTube channel, my videos, you know, why don't I just get serious about it? It's the weirdest way. Like, I've been teaching guitar forever, but so I actually said to my wife, I'm going to start making tutorials and I'll start tabbing them as well. I'll start doing this properly, you know, because I've got a really studied musical background. I know how to do that, which has been a real blessing. And I started, you know, transcribe. Like, I think one of the first ones I did was Gargoyles Over Copenhagen by Necromantics. I did a Tiger Army tune. Just stuff that I really liked, and I already had set the Patreon up, but again, I wasn't doing regular videos, so I think it didn't really matter. Mm-hmm. But once I started saying, "Hey, world, I've got a Patreon. I'm going to put the transcriptions here, and they're going to go along with my videos now. And if you sign up, you get the transcriptions." I went from like one or two Patreons to, you know, 10 to 20 to 50, 75, 100, 150, and now it's at around 188, I think.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's like having an extra part-time job.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so I guess as the young'uns call it, a side hustle, in a way.
A side hustle.
It maybe has a little bit more work to it, you know, with the transcribing and things like that. Do you maybe like one song like a month or something like that, or like what? How often do you like, you know, do stuff on your Patreon and your YouTube?
I make roughly a video a week, but I do a transcription maybe once a month, sometimes every 6 weeks, because they're a lot of work. You know, I mean, it's if people knew, you know, it's like if I smash out a song, an entire song, I might be able to do that in 4 hours if I get a good run. Mm, you know, yeah, right. Okay. My ears have gotten better and better from doing it. So I did that Detonator song recently, and that took me maybe 2 hours, 2.5 hours from start to finish. My ears were good that day. Your ears are on some days and you hear things and you can pretty much peg down what's happening pretty quick. But it's notating the timing. For anyone that knows anything about reading music, like notating the actual rhythm of everything, especially in wild guitar solos, that's really challenging. But yeah, it's like, so that's a quick one. I've spent 8 hours on some, or 10 hours, you know, and then you've got to tidy up the transcription. Then you've got to make sure you can play it well enough to actually teach it. So you've got to practice it a bit. You've got to listen to the song so much, and then making the video, you know, you've got to make the video, and then you've got to edit the video, and that can take up to 4 hours sometimes. Drop 20 hours.
Really cool feeling. It really must be a really cool feeling though when you do these videos, because I saw Chris Cheney commented on one of your videos. I think it was the one which you did for
E-Boogie.
The E-Boogie one. Yeah, I saw that he commented and he said that you did a fantastic job. How does that feel, man? How does it feel to have the actual creator of those licks and those tunes to come through and say, man, that's a fantastic job?
It's really cool. It's I don't know. It's kind of funny because I guess sometimes I go after these really complicated songs and it's almost my own challenge, you know. But it's also, you know, if I'm honest, sometimes it's really nice to be able to show the world I can do that. In fact, I can tell you everything he's doing. You know, it's like I've put so much time and effort into this. So sometimes that's my own. It's almost like I'm tuning my own trumpet a bit. It's like, yeah, I'll work that out. You know, but yeah, you don't expect them to see that and notice that. But there's a real, I assume there's a real respect in that. So it's kind of nice. It feels like you're getting a lot of respect when they, you know, can see the hard work. Because a lot of those guys know too that it's one thing to even play it. It's another thing to transcribe it and put it on notation and play it as well. You know, I don't know. Yeah, it's just awesome. It's really, really cool. That was a really nice moment when Chris Cheney saw that. It's like to be on his radar is really nice. I have met him a couple of times. He did see the Vaudevillains play when we supported Necromantics and I spoke to him at the show. Yeah. So yeah, it's kind of nice. Someone like that, you know, they meet so many people in their lives too. And even if he remembered you at one point, there's not, you know, every chance he won't remember you now. So to be back and, you know, on his radar at all is really cool. Obviously I was a huge fan of The Living End when I was, you know, in my teenage years and it put me on this course to a degree. So
yeah, for sure.
It's awesome.
Well, that's what I was, I'm glad you kind of said that because I was going to actually, it helps with my segue into my next sort of question, which is how did it all begin for you, man? How did you get into music and then eventually decide to pick up the guitar and, you know, master it the way you have now?
Well, it's funny because this cracks me up because this past couple of years, actually, I've been on a huge trip with, you know, learning more about myself and how everything works. And one of the hugest things is I've sort of, you know, really tapping into these days is realizing how much our childhoods, you know, impact our lives and sort of almost sets like a framework for how you view everything. So I sort of had this really ironic moment lately where I thought, we were raised with this like really high regard for musicians. So this is where I'll go with that story first. We were raised with a really high regard for musicians. My grandma was a musician.
Yeah.
And she played professionally. So she was an organ player and she would take pop music and arrange it for organ and sing. And and she did that a couple of nights a week. I think she got paid really good money back then. So it was a really high regarded thing. And so for me growing up, it was like all us kids were going to do something with music to a degree. You know, my brother was a drummer from the time he could pick up sticks. And then, you know, my sister got into piano later. She was a bit younger. So my older brother was already playing drums when I was growing up. And then I remember I wanted to play guitar from the age of about 5. You know, I even at 6 years old, before I started having lessons, did the old microphone in the guitar trick in the karaoke machine. And
it was inevitable.
It was inevitable.
Surrounded by music.
Yeah. It was inevitable, yeah. And so I remember at school, they had some musicians come to school and they were going to set up a music program. And I was actually going to do drums though, because that's what was in the family. You know, everyone played drums kind of thing. And then the day before I changed my mind, the night before we took in the slips, I said, all right, I'll do guitar. And man, that was that. So like I was into it.
Best last minute decision.
Oh
ever.
My God. Isn't it funny? You know? and even now there's so many great things that are still coming to me from playing guitar. So yeah, that's how I started. And my first guitar teacher sort of got me a little bit into blues and stuff. And I was always learning to read music, which was a great thing. Cause at that age, you don't question it. At 7 years old, you don't really question it. You just, yep, cool. Yeah. And if the sounds sound good, you know, that works. But believe it or not, one of the pivotal things was, you know, my mum used to tell me, put your guitar in the case when you're not playing it. And it was this horrible zip up case with this plasticky, vinyl-y cheap stuff. It was really hard to put in. So it was easier just to not practice. You know, it was like,
yeah,
it's too hard. So weeks would go by and I wouldn't get much practice. And then one week I decided, you know what? I went and I said, my mum was always very reasonable. She's always been very reasonable. I went to her and I said, Mum, I'm just going to leave it out because it's way harder. Can I just put the case away and I'll just take it out of the case when I get home and I'll put the case under the bed? And she said, yeah, whatever. And then I was practicing all the time because I could just pick it up.
Yeah.
And then I remember like Saturday night, everyone would be watching a movie and I'd be I'd be, you know, we'd be halfway through the movie and I'd start getting bored and I'd go practice Saturday night. I'd be sitting in my room practicing guitar. You know, it's like even at 8, 9 years old, I was, you know, and I'd just be learning songs out of a book with notes, you know, and but I love that. And then I remember going to my parents one day and saying, you know, I don't actually know any songs. And they were really good about it. They were like, okay, well, they had nothing. We had nothing to do that day. We didn't do much, you know. My parents didn't really like to go out that much and stuff. But that day,
they were,
I remember,
quite chill, were they?
You could call it that.
So, call it that. Okay.
We jumped on a train and we went to the city and we bought some fat books of songs, and they had the chords and the melody. And then I started just learning how to play songs. You know, I'll never forget, like, Sound of Silence and all these songs I'd heard on Gold FM or whatever was on the radio, just anything and everything that was recognizable. And actually, I think Folsom Prison was in that book.
Okay, yep.
And I remember being, this is a funny story, I remember being like, I don't know, I might have been in grade 6 or year 7 or something, and we were playing Tony Hawk's and we heard this song, Folsom Prison, on Tony Hawk's. And we somehow made the connection that, oh, hang on, that's in this book. This is that song from Tony Hawk's. And then I remember meeting my sister. I think it was Ring of Fire. It might have been Ring of Fire, actually. Yeah, it, probably both, because that game weirdly had a whole bunch of Johnny Cash on it. But I remember us sitting there and singing and playing that song and trying to figure it out, you know. So that was my brush with Johnny Cash quite early. And
that was the start, yeah.
Yeah, and then also my mum loved the Beatles. We had this box set as well, full of tapes that we'd listen to in the car whenever we went on holidays. We had the Jive Bunny set, and that was just great.
What road trip was it? Wasn't a road trip until someone broke out the
Jive Bunny.
the Jive Bunny. Absolutely, it's not a road trip without the Jive Bunny.
Well, it just shows how well they marketed those cassette boxes. It was like it must have been in the marketing. This is for you. Take this on your road trip. You know, we've got this cassette. All the cassettes are in there. Take it in the car.
Yep.
It was great.
Yeah. It ends up being played at every quintessential 50s night as well. You know, it's like, yes, this is 50s enough. Here you go.
Yeah. And, you know, even at primary school, they had this thing where at the end of lunchtime, we'd be picking up rubbish. We had this thing when the music came on, you had to pick up rubbish. And they would play Jive Bunny stuff.
Oh, cool.
I loved it.
That's all right.
I loved it.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. My folks, they listen to similar sort of stuff as well, like the Beatles, Roy Orbison, all those sorts of guys, and, the Beach Boys, all that kind of stuff too. And I kind of grew up around that sort of stuff too. And but my folks, they weren't musically inclined at all. So I had to kind of work that all out myself. So, yeah, that's all cool. So that's kind of where it sort of started with you. It was inevitable that you were going to be picking up an instrument. And the night before you decided to put down the guitar instead of the drums. How it's cool that you can kind of pinpoint it to that sort of point too.
Yeah, well, you know, what I was going to say, I sort of touched on, but it's funny because now I look back and go, well, the only reason we held musicians in such high regard was because my grandma was a musician, and, you know, she kind of held herself in quite high regard, if I'm honest. You know, she was pretty stern and you know, she could be very ceremonious about what she had done. And it's funny because I recently reflected, I'm like, is it such a high regard thing? It's cool. But, you know, for us, it's almost like a policeman, or it was like a policeman or a lawyer, or, you know, probably or a doctor. I should say a doctor because, you know, in particular. But it's like,
because,
you know, they're respectable jobs. It's like musicians are just playing music, you know, but.
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah, it's sort of like it was also somewhat concentrated then for you as well. You know, you're completely surrounded by all these musicians, and whereas a lot of the general sort of public wouldn't necessarily be surrounded by all these musicians and not know the hard work it sometimes takes to be a musician, you know. So, you know, sometimes when you're sort of surrounded by that sort of thing, you're going to get a much higher concentration of it.
Yeah, and, more exposure, everything, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And so with that, after you sort of picked up the guitar and you started to learn a few songs, when did you sort of step into your first band?
First band? Well, so my uncle my uncle Gab, Gabriel Rossi, he's a comedian, and he works in that sort of ethnic humor. So, because I've got Italian background, so they, you know, they call it wog humor, you know, because they're wogs, etc. I don't know. I know it's politically incorrect, but that's their genre of comedy, you know.
It's part of history.
You know, and they love it, you know, and it's got a really big audience, especially in Melbourne. So he makes a living doing that, and he did a show called Melbourne the Musical, and it was he would sing about suburbs of Melbourne, and he got me to perform with him, and my brother played drums in the show, and we actually did Thursday to Sunday for 4 weeks, and I think I was 14 at the time, so Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday night, there we were at, you know, setting up, sound checking and doing this sort of comedy show. I only did a couple of songs with him. And then they revived that show, I think a year later, and he got me to do more songs. So I was playing live at a venue from the age of 13 or 14, which was pretty cool. That was really cool. And then my first, you know, I think when I was about 16 or 17, I had the inevitable high school band where we played covers and thought we were the biggest rock stars. And, you know, we got to play with Area 7 at a community gig. And Chucky T was so cool. And I remember I said to him,
Chuck's a great bloke.
Because I was so arrogant as a kid, like, you know, but, you know, to be fair, I'm 15 or 16 and I'm, you know, think I'm really good at guitar. It's naturally you're going to be arrogant sort of thing. But I remember saying to him, like, I can play like Chris Cheney. And because I'd been learning all these solos. And I remember him saying, he's like, yeah, try saying that if he's in the room with you. And I was like, I didn't really get that at the time, but now I do. It's like, you know, there's always more to it. Just because I'd learned a couple of his solos didn't make me, you know, be able to play guitar like him. It's very different. But it was a funny experience, actually. I still have to laugh at myself at that age. But I like it's saying even the Vaudevillains, man, like obviously I'd grown up a little bit, but I knew what we wanted to do. I was so focused on where we could get to. I felt like I knew we could really go places, and it was happening, you know. It was like, you know, supporting Tiger Army and Necromantics, and I had an amazing conversation with Nick 13 about the band. He was just so encouraging and so impressed, like he was telling me tracks off the EP that we'd sent them, you know, that he really liked.
Oh wow. So that just shows that he, you know, he had a good thorough listen, didn't he?
Yeah, he like genuinely really liked the album, the EP, and yeah, I've probably jumped to a question you were going to ask anyway, because I'm sure we're going to get to the Vaudevillains.
That's all right. Yeah, so I was actually going to be sort of like my next sort of like question. So you had your sort of like high school band. What kind of music did you guys play in high school? Was it all like, I know it was all covers, but was it like punk covers or?
Yeah, I'm glad you came back to that, because, you know, it was a really funny time. I mean, we would have been doing Grinspoon, a bit of AC/DC. I reckon we did some Living End songs. But I remember, I think we did some Queens of the Stone Age, you know, but I remember being starved a little bit for something bigger, something more interesting. You know, I remember not feeling particularly satisfied with music, you know, and I felt like the Living End were great, but even I even knew within myself that you can't just love one band. You'll end up sounding like one band until this girl at school had a horror pop sticker. So I just, you know, started listening to the horror pops and, you know, I mean, I grew up in the northern suburbs, like I wouldn't say no culture. There's a lot of culture, but that sort of rockabilly, hot rod culture, 50s music, psychobilly,
custom culture, sort of
custom
thing,
culture. Yeah. That's it. There was nothing, nothing at all. You know, you might occasionally on someone's hotted up car see a Clay Smith cam sticker. But when I discovered, I stopped a guy in the city one day who had one of the Hot Rod shirts and he had a quiff. And I said to him, where do you get your shirts? Where do you get your haircut? And he said to me, go down there, turn right. There was a shop called Route 66. And he said, go in there and he said, and ask him about the haircuts because they know the guys from the barbers and they'll send you there. And then, oh man, that's when I was like I was stoked, because I went to one of those shops, I started finding the clothes, me and my friend got our haircuts and we thought we were so cool, you know, when we first had our quiffs. You know, it was the best. It was so awesome.
I love that time. I love that time of discovery. You know, it's like you think you're king shit because, you know, you just you found all this fantastic new stuff that no one else is into, you know, and like you think you're king shit.
Well, it was funny because I remember, I reckon it must have been a little bit later, because what happened was, yeah, I was in year 12, so I was 17, maybe 18. I would have been 18, actually. I just started driving. And so I'd been to Route 66, and me and my friend caught a train out there, and I bought a whole bunch of clothes and stuff. But actually, I hadn't got my hair cut from a proper barber at that point. So I remember, this is what happened. So at Route 66, we heard some awesome music, and I'm like, oh my God, what is this? And the lady's like, oh, they're a band called Zombie Ghost Train. Right. And I'm like, this is unreal. So then we went back into the city, and then I found the CD and I bought it, and holy cow, man, that album changed. That's one of those albums that changed my life. It was just so good, you know? So it was pretty cool because, it was like a week later, Zombie Ghost Train were playing.
Okay.
So I was like, well, let's go see Zombie Ghost Train. So we go to the Tote, and I think we clearly didn't fit in. Perfect Sin were playing, and I don't know if it was their fan base, or like, those guys are great. Love those. I still actually see some of the guys. I ran into one of those guys who's now like a session drummer, sort of like how I get a bit of session work playing with different bands. You know, we bumped into each other and we sort of made the connection. But we go to the Tote, we walk in, and I swear to God, because we didn't quite have the proper quiffs, like, we kind of did them ourselves. We like gave each other haircuts. Me and my mate were like trying to give each other quiffs, right? This is the stuff you do when you're 18, you know? And they had this idea. There was this a little bit of this weird culture with psychobilly in Australia where it was like, I think people got a bit carried away with the toughness side. And it was like, you know, I remember,
I know what you mean.
You know, they're smashing into each other and brawling in the pit, not wrecking in any kind of fun way. Like, it just went too far.
It wasn't necessarily wrecking, was it? No. It was more like, let's see if we can hurt this person.
That's right. And it kept being me and my friend. Like, me and my mate were just getting hammered left, right, and center.
Yeah, right. Okay.
But the thing was, like, and look, I don't condone violence anymore. I'm very, very different now. But at that point in time, I was kickboxing and doing all this crazy stuff when I was young, especially growing up in the northern suburbs, you know. And I was just guys would start shoving me, and I'd shove them back a bit, and then they'd start swinging at me, and then bang, like, I knocked a few guys over that. I got in like three fights at that gig. It was crazy. And one guy fully jumped me and was trying to, like, doing the hockey style. I was trying to smash my face in, and I don't even know what I did, but I ended up putting him on his ass. And then I thought, oh, he's going to get back up and we're going to go another round. And he was like, nah, I'm sorry. And then all these mates backed off, and I was like, thank God. And it was funny because he'd actually basically king hit me. Like, he'd come up out of nowhere and just gone for a huge punch. And this was kind of my introduction to the psychobilly scene. Like, we'd never been to a gig before. And it was so funny because I'd seen him coming, and I'd seen a girl sort of point at me. I don't know what had happened, but whatever. They decided they needed to take us out. It didn't work out for him. He came up to me after the gig. And he apologized, and he said, oh, a girl put me up to it. And I was just like, that's just sad, mate. Like, that's sad. So that was like our first gig. So we left that night, and it was like, that was awesome. And we were totally like hooked, you know? it was so weird, man. It was like, that's actually what I thought it was going to be like, though. You know, I learned later. Okay. That's not how it should be. It's, you know. People just love the music and the culture, and wrecking's supposed to be fun. And I remember, what's his name from Mad Sin?
Kufta.
I remember him getting really upset at everybody at the Hi-Fi Bar in Melbourne. He just cracked it and was like, that's not wrecking. He's like, if you keep hurting people, you're going to have to wreck with me. And it was like, thank God. Like, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I had the fortune of the good fortune of interviewing Kufta, and he is a menacing thing to be around. He's like, you kind of feel protected, but you kind of got to make sure you don't say the wrong thing. It's like we at one point, Mike and I were interviewing. We were interviewing him in the in his hotel room, and we just slightly alluded to to the meteors. And, oh boy, he was like, what did he say about me? You've got to tell me what he said about it. It was like, oh, no, we're just alluding to it, mate. You could see his, like, he was starting to shift. But, yes.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah, those were good days, though, in the Mad Sin days when they came to Australia. That was something else. That was fantastic.
That was awesome. And that, so I was with Manic Pistoleros then. And that was such a great... I loved playing in that band. It was awesome. It was just... I just loved playing guitar. I did a tiny bit of backup singing and I could just shred, jump around the stage. Man, I had a ball. And that
which band came first for you, man? Which one was it? Was it the Vaudevillains first?
Yeah,
or was it,
the Vaudevillains. Manic? No, the Vaudevillains.
Okay.
Yeah, no. I was playing in the Vaudevillains and Manic Pistoleros at one point. And
So you're playing both at one point. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, as you know, but the Vaudevillains came to an end around a similar time, so there wasn't too much crossover. And you remember the demise of the Vaudevillains?
This is going to be one of my questions, man, because there was only a handful of people in the room at the time. But first things first, before we go on to the demise of Vaudevillains, let's talk about how it all kind of began. Let's start there.
Let's wait for the man. We've got
How did the Vaudevillains sort of come about for you, man? How did that sort of start?
I was so I finished year 12, and I knew that I wanted to study music, and I had no idea that you could go to uni. Like, this is the thing, man. Growing up in the northern suburbs, like, it really, I see now the the impacted demographic yeah,
yeah.
Because I didn't even know I could go do a degree doing music. I'd heard about this diploma that, you know, apparently Chris Cheney did, and there's this course that's amazing. You're going to learn how to play all the jazzy stuff and whatever.
Yeah.
It worked out so different to what I thought, but it did provide the foundation that really helped. So I went and did this course, and it was just a TAFE course. And there just happened to be another guy in my class who, he had, you know, long hair, looked like a metalhead, but I remember him wearing a Tiger Army t-shirt. But I hadn't even heard Tiger Army. Because it wasn't like if you wanted to hear a band, then you had to find a CD and play it. Like, I still can't get over how ridiculously easy it is to access everything now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, for sure.
But it's killed the value at the same time. It's a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation now. It's really weird. But
no, that's right. Yeah, there have been some sacrifices made along the way to have this sort of thing. And
these huge games.
Yeah, that's right. So you're at TAFE.
Guy's got a Tiger Army shirt. We struck up a conversation. He was a really good bass player. One day, we got along really well. One day, we went to get lunch, and in his car, he showed me Tiger Army. And, man, when I heard Never Die, that guitar tone especially, those chords, you know, the fact that he wasn't just playing power chords. And they were nothing incredibly creative for most genres, but for punk or psychobilly, he was using these big minor chords and this clean tone. That Never Die stuff, that do, 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 do. Oh man, it just, I loved that. And it's funny because that was my real love for psychobilly came through the lens of sort of the modern psychobilly.
Okay, yep.
And so a lot of guys that are into psychobilly, they don't like that stuff. It's like, oh, that's no good. It's like, yeah, but I really love certain aspects of old school psychobilly as well. Like, it becomes not about the genre, it becomes about the particular band or even the particular song. Like Crewman, you know, they have some killer songs. But anyway, I'm getting off the track.
Yes, you are.
Yeah.
Come on, focus, man.
I do that. Sorry, we need to get to the good stuff. So anyway, we were really into Tiger Army and so, you know, we made this connection. Then back then you had to order a double bass from some website to get it imported from China. And we waited and we waited, and it took months to come. And then he got his double bass, and then I'd already written a couple of songs, and we started putting those songs together, and then we recorded a demo. His dad had a friend that did recording just at home.
Yep.
We went around his house. Our first demo was actually recorded with electric drums, and then we used that with MySpace to start getting gigs. And we would, like, you know, message venues. And I remember it was actually a band called The Hibernators that found us on MySpace and said, hey, do you want to come and play with us?
Yeah.
And that's sort of how we got started. And it was James. So James was the guy at TAFE. It was his younger brother, Michael or Mix, that, he joined the band. And, we started rehearsing every Sunday. I was driving an hour every Sunday just about to go rehearse with him to Werribee. A long drive, you know. My parents would be like, "Where are you going?" I'm like, "Werribee." They'd be like, they'd be shocked. Like, that's a long way. Anyway, so we started rehearsing. We started, you know, putting the demo out there once we'd recorded the demo. And then we got like one gig, and then, you know, we sort of got another gig, and then we started getting better gigs. And you know, I remember the first gig we played, we had no one come, you know, maybe one person, like a friend of mine. And then like maybe by our third gig, I remember we supported the Runaway Boys, and there were two girls sitting there, and I just went up and said, "Oh, hi, who are you guys here to see?" And they're like, "The Vaudevillains." And I was like, "Wow, that's cool." And then it just grew from there really quickly. We started playing SB Front Bar and get, you know, there'd be like 10 or 15 people. Then we did a show at Public Bar, which is a tiny room. And we had, you know, I think like 50 people it might've even been like a Monday night. It was crazy. It was really building fast. And then we got the Necromantic support, which I was obsessed with getting. Like, we had to get that support. I'd become a huge fan of Necromantics in all of that time. And that was it. Once we got that gig and a lot of people saw us, we were starting to get really good numbers. You know, we could put on a show in the middle of winter and get 120 payers, you know, in a reasonably small venue. Okay. It was really good. Like, I look back now and go, holy cow. You know, we our first EP launch, 196 payers at the Tote. And I think they said we're closing the doors at 200, you know. So
far out.
That's
amazing.
And we'd only been gigging for 6 months at that point, I think.
Far out. So, that is incredible. So it's such a short period of time, you had a decent following. Yeah, within like a 6 month period, you had a decent following there.
It just started to explode really quick, you know. And then I'll never forget. I was thinking about this the other day. It's funny. So I got asked to play a gig this coming Friday with a Get Rhythm Johnny Cash show, and I did that last week, and they loved having me, and they initially weren't sure if they had the budget, but they've come back to me and said, "Look, we really want you to come to Tassie next Friday." So I'm doing that this Friday coming. And I thought, you know, it's funny, it's full circle, because the very first time I got on a plane was to play a gig when I was in the Vaudevillains. We got invited to play over in Tasmania, you know, by the Bone Rattlers guys, actually, if you remember those guys.
With the Bone Rattlers, I was about to say, would that by chance be with the Bone Rattlers? Because they were pretty much the only sort of psychobilly band from Tasmania that I could remember.
Yeah, they got off. They did some really cool stuff, and they were such cool guys, man. We had so much fun with those guys. Like, yeah, and like it was just so nice of them to they came to us. They had a committee that saved up money to bring bands over, and man, we felt like such rock stars. Like, I'd never even been on a plane before, and yet here I am getting on a plane to go play a gig. I couldn't believe it. You know, again, from the northern suburbs of Melbourne, you know, growing up in Dallas, Broadmeadows, and then, you know, never even being on a plane in my life, you know, to we listened to Jive Bunny and drove to the same holiday location every year, you know.
Yeah. And so whereabouts did you get to go with the Vaudevillains? Like, did you get to go overseas at all, like, or was it all just sort of local?
No, well, we went all over Australia. You know, we played Adelaide a couple of times. We played Sydney a couple of times. We played Queensland a couple. We had great gigs in Queensland. We went to Tassie a couple of times. It was the trouble really began with that band when I wanted to go overseas. It was like I was making the connections, and we just needed to buy tickets. We got to a point where we just needed to buy tickets to fly over. But the gigs were going to be sorted for us. Couches were going to be provided. You know, we would have been roughing it, but you know, there was a support network there that was ready to help us.
Oh, especially if you went to Europe or something like that. If you went to Europe, you'd be very well looked after. I know quite a few people over there, and they just, in fact, you'd probably come back a few kilos heavier because of the hospitality that they've got over there.
I don't doubt it. Look, I was all for it. When James had said to me, they had full-time jobs, and so I didn't really understand it, because I didn't have a full-time job, and I just saved really hard so I could do these things. But there was this discussion about, I owe $1,000 to my brother or something from a trip to Thailand we did, and so I can't afford to go. And I said, that's cool. Like, I don't hold that against people. So I reached out to Reckless, Captain Reckless, you know, which we'd played with Zombie Ghost Train a lot of times. We got to play with so many bands. Like, we got to do gigs with obviously Tiger Army, Zombie Ghost Train. We got to play with Necromantics, the Fireballs. You know, we were getting to play so many awesome gigs, and I became really good friends with Reckless. And I rang him and I basically said, hey, if I go to Europe, you want to come? And he was like, I am in. Let's do it. So should we get to that gig? Should we talk about the gig?
Let's do it, man. Let's do it. Let's do it. Because I, from my recollection, I emceed that, I think.
Yeah.
I can't remember if I did or not. But yeah, I emceed that gig, and our good friends from the Chicken Stones. They were playing there. And so I remember emceeing that, and I was really excited to see you guys play, because that may have been what made your second time playing in Sydney.
I think it was. And,
and so I know I was really excited because we had been promoting it on our radio show as well, and so we were really keen for it. And the fact that I was emceeing it maybe have had something to do with it too. But
nah.
I remember you guys were on stage, and there was just something wrong from the very beginning.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the guy, the other guys were, oh my God, they were, like, I always laugh at this. Every time I've said to other musicians, oh man, the, you know, the band got so drunk, they, you know, they're like, oh, that happens all the time. I'm like, no, no. It's like, no, no. They couldn't stand up.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember, look, I don't hold any grudge now. It's totally fine. But I have to go into some details because it's hilarious. Like, I remember looking to my left and James was on his knees with his head over the bass. The double bass was laying on the ground, and he was just plonking at it like he didn't know what it was.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like a horror show. And in the middle of drumming, yeah, Michael stopped and he took his jumper off in the middle of Reaper or something. You're like, dooch, dooch. And he's just like, I'm hot. Just stops, takes it off.
Mm-hmm.
It was a horror show, you know? And you know, the suckiest thing was I wasn't even mad. I was like, you know what? It happens. These things happen. Mm-hmm. We had 35 pays that night. I remember that stuff for some reason. And I was disappointed for them, but I was also kind of amused for them, because I was like, it's not something you're going to see every day at this level. Like, this is crazy.
No. It's not every time you see a band breaking up live on stage.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I said to him, like, the next day, I said, it's all good. We have Apollo Bay Music Festival coming up. Now, we were like, we were getting all these amazing slots to play because the booker and I got along great. She was so impressed that I had run the band, that we'd done all these things. Because every time we had a booker, it didn't work. Every time we had a manager, it didn't work, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She had said to me, you're so communicative. If I ask for something, you do it. And she said, we're going to put you on the Saturday night in town. Two bands get to play. She said, they're usually big label bands. She said, to hell with it. You guys are going to play. And she said, the reason it's such a sought after gig is Apollo Bay Music Festival gets all types. Like, it gets, you know, Casey Chambers was playing that year, and they're the kind of acts. Right. And she said, on the Saturday night, everybody, it's the who's who of the music industry there. She goes, you guys are, I think we might have even been headlining or co-main. It was huge, right? And I said to the guys, you know what, forget about tonight. Let's just sort our stuff out. We'll play that gig at Apollo Bay, and it's going to fix everything. This is going to be great. Don't worry about it, you know? And I said to the guy, because I knew the bass player was upset that I was going to go to Europe without him, but it was like, I was like, you said you can't go. I was just solving a problem, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So leading up to that Apollo Bay gig, and mind you, I feel like I need to stress too that I did all the booking, all the posters. I drive into the city to pick up CDs and everything for that band. And the other guys would get upset sometimes and say, why don't we get to do stuff? And I would say, sure, you do it. You take responsibility. And then it wouldn't get done. And then they'd be apologetic. It was just a joke. Like, it was so frustrating. But we were young. Everyone was young. So, again, I don't hold anything against anyone. But that Apollo Bay gig coming up on the Saturday, I think it was the Monday before, the drummer messaged me and he said, sorry, I've got a recording session with my new band. Like, he had a new band. It was just nothing. He said, I've got a recording session with my new band. So I can't go to Apollo Bay. And I was like, I reckon I'd never felt that angry in my life. Like, I felt just completely gutted. I was like, so I just messaged him and his brother, and I said, I'm done with you guys. That's it. And that was it.
Yeah.
So
that was it.
And yeah, and look, that was, it's funny because I still think that, you know, everyone's got like their heartbreak story about a girl. Like that was mine.
Yeah. That was, well, the Vaudevillains, you loved that band, didn't you?
Oh man, I just, it was my heart and soul, that band. I think that was something that the other guy struggled with too, was I don't know what was going on in their heads, but I you know, when you're young, it's almost like as you get older, you move away from narcissism, hopefully. You become less about yourself.
Yeah.
And so I think there was probably a lot going on. I think they were a little bit scared of the success, but I think there was a little bit of jealousy as well. But like I said, whenever I passed the ball to them, things wouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. But I was never mean about it either. I don't know. I think it was just too good a thing. They couldn't really handle it. I spoke to them both afterwards over the years. You know, I saw one and then I saw ran into the other or whatever. And Michael just said, you know, I knew you and James were at tension about going overseas and I just didn't want a bar of it anymore. You know, very, not the best way to do it. But look, I could have just got other people and continued on. But I don't know, something about it was like, maybe I was just done with that whole thing. So,
yeah, it just felt maybe the time was, it was time to move on maybe, you know. It's one of the things that I remember from that night, and I kind of really clearly picture it, is I've never seen a snare drum get punched so much in my life. That snare drum was getting absolutely hammered, was getting punched like crazy.
Punched, like, with his fist?
Yeah.
That's right.
With his fist, everything.
Yeah, because he was making mistakes and punching the drum. You know, was that what was happening, or did he belt it afterwards because he was upset?
Well, it kind of ended with him punching the living crap out of his own snare drum. So that's kind of what I remember.
Wow.
That's what I kind of remember. Wow. And that was some night, man. That was, well, as you said, the 35 payers that you did have that night, they certainly got a show to remember.
They saw something, you know, they saw something different. You know, I mean, I don't know. Yeah, you'd think that a lot of people there would remember that weird night that band from Melbourne came up. And I mean, I should have just told them to get off stage and played by myself. It would have been a half decent show.
Yeah, come to think of it, yeah, I never actually thought of that. I just saw the demise and I thought, man, how are you going to continue after that? But credit to you, though, man, you held it together so well whilst everyone was, you know, on the ground, you know, plucking away at his bass and the other one was punching the living crap out of his drum kit. There you were, still playing along, going, I'm sorry about this all, folks.
Yeah.
I remember. What can you do?
Do you know what's crazy? I'm spewing because the guy behind the desk took a recording and he said to me, he said, hey, did you want the recording? I said, nah. But oh my God, it would have been the best to have. Like, it would have been amazing. Sure. I mean, yeah, I don't remember who the sound guy was and I highly doubt he still has it, but you never know. If we ever figure out who it was, I'll have to see if he's got it. So,
yeah. Well, you briefly touched on it before, but you were also in the Manic Pistol Eros for a short period of time, weren't you?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And that would have been, and those guys, they didn't really get to come up to Sydney much at all, did they?
I think we did Newcastle, but I don't think we ever got to Sydney. And that band really, that band kind of came to an end. There were just sort of musical differences between, you know, I think Al and then sort of the rest of us in a way. But I, in hindsight, I really regret that because I think that band, if we just looked at it for what it was great and it was cool. And as much as musically we wanted to do certain things that I think Al wasn't particularly interested in doing, because he came from that punk background and that sort of real tough, hard-edged punk background, I think he didn't really like some of the more colourful stuff we were trying to do. It was a bit more creative. So the other guys might have felt a bit stifled at times. And but it was all silly. It was all like, you know what? Well, that's okay. Let's all just work this out and evolve together because we had something really cool and it was really fun to play. So, but, you know, that's all right. That's life. I'm doing heaps of cool stuff that I'm enjoying now. I really enjoy just being a gun for hire. You know, I'm sort of playing in...
Mate, you keep on helping me here with these with these transitions here, because that was going to be my last question was, what's next for Adrian? What's Adrian currently doing, and what can we possibly see from Adrian White in the future?
Well, I've got this really cool gig with this Get Rhythm show. It's a really cool show. So it's this couple, this husband and wife who are just obsessed with Johnny Cash and June Carter, and they really nail it. Mm-hmm. You know, Sun Rising, the other Sun record show I do, is very different. We're just sort of musicians playing the songs quite authentically. This is a show, they're completely different to me. They're apples and oranges, but they sort of do a bit of the imitation thing, but, you know, they sort of come back to themselves every now and then and have a bit of a laugh. It's really cool. There's this really mm-hmm. nice self-awareness about the show. But it's just great fun, you know, and I'm playing all, like, it's a weird collection of Johnny Cash stuff. So I'm really happy about that. That's cool. Sun Rising. So there's the Get Rhythm show, there's Sun mm-hmm. Rising. I do a lot of solo guitar arrangements and jazz stuff because I just love playing that stuff on guitar. But my next big project, which is really the biggest thing I've undertaken, I think, since the Vaudevillains, is that I'm opening a guitar school, like a bigger guitar school. So I teach out of this one room, but I've got mm-hmm. some other teachers doing a bit of work for me, and they're doing really well. So I'm like, okay, let's take a plunge, get a bigger space with two big rooms. I might start running band workshops and stuff. Look, I'm not fussed about becoming... I love the YouTube thing to grow, and I love being an authority and teaching the guitar stuff because I'm so passionate about it. But I'm not too concerned with, you know, being an original artist and becoming famous or anything. I'm not too worried about that. I'm more excited.
You're going to be an influencer?
What? Apparently that's what I am doing on YouTube. But I don't know. I'm just doing my thing. And look, the guitar school is something I really want to do. Taking that to another level. So that's the next big thing is the guitar suite is now going to become a place that's it's not an actual shop front, but it's behind the shop front, so we'll have street frontage. It's a big touring place. I'm going to get electric drums so the kids can jam, and I've already got a double bass. We might get a keyboard in there as well. I want to do band workshops, and like, I want to share the joy that I've got from music with other people too, and get them playing and get them having some of the experiences that I've had, even if it's just in that room, you know.
Yeah, I've got to say, it's been absolutely fantastic sort of watching the progress. You know, as someone who sort of, I like to sit back and just watch as people really, really delve into their passions, and that's what I've just seen you do over the years. It's like where you were for a little while there, you were doing a lot of the finger picking stuff on.
I've lost your audio, mate. Sorry, you're back. Yeah, you're just I lost you at the finger picking stuff. I think on YouTube, maybe, is it, or
yes, yeah, man. I remember seeing all that finger picking stuff that you were doing, like showing that you can have multiple instruments coming from the one.
You know, yes,
if you know what I mean. So
I do.
You know, from Journey and all those sorts of guys, you know, and so
yeah,
it's been absolutely fantastic, sort of watching the progress. I mean, it was interesting watching the downfall of the Vaudevillains, but then just see what's happened after that. You know, it's been, it's been fantastic, and it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, man. Thank you very much. I know you've got to go. I've got to go.
Yeah, let's all go.
Absolutely. But, man, thank you so much for joining me on my podcast. I dare say we may do an update in the future, see how we're all going.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah.
I would love that. Thank you so much for having me on the show, man. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you so much, man. And again, keep up the awesome work, and I'll keep up the support, okay?
Thanks, mate. I really appreciate it.
All right, mate. Take care. See ya.
See you later, mate. Bye.
Cheers, mate. Bye.